the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed. Pakistan has reached a milestone for democracy. For the first time, Pakistan has transferred power from one democratically elected government to another. The voters on Saturday rejected the incumbent party and picked the party led by former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif. Sharif is now putting together a coalition. At midweek, he met with his main rival in the very aggressive campaign, a popular cricket player turned politician named Imran Khan. Today on Global Journalist, we'll explore the impact of the national elections in Pakistan, both within the country and on international relations. In the second segment of our show, I'll talk to an executive at one of Kenya's largest media groups. Our guests are two scholars with particular expertise in Pakistan. Michael Kugelman is a senior program associate at the Woodrow Wilson Center. And Marvin Weinbaum is a scholar in residence at the Middle East Institute. He's also been an analyst for Pakistan and Afghanistan in the U.S. Department of State's Bureau of Intelligence and Research. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Michael, you wrote in an article in Foreign Policy magazine a few days before the weekend election, and you wrote that it appears to be more of a watershed for militancy than for democracy, because after all, more than 100 people were killed in the month leading up to the election. Pakistan's Taliban targeted three of the major political parties in the former government. Did those attacks have an impact on the outcome?
Well, I think the point I made in that article was that the election would have been a watershed for militancy if turnout was heavily affected.
Uh-huh.
But in fact, the turnout was so strong, 60% is the figure that I've heard. That's more than in the last U.S. presidential election. I would say that it would be inaccurate and unfair to say that it was not a watershed for democracy because the turnout was there. And also, certainly, there was a tremendous amount of violence leading up to the election and on election day itself. But to put things in perspective, unfortunately, in Pakistan and in South Asia, generally speaking, election-related violence is simply a reality. And when it comes down to it, the areas where the violence was heaviest happened to be where the fewest parliamentary seats were up for grabs. So.
Right.
I don't really think that there was any sort of direct impact on the outcome, though you do have to wonder that if the incumbent Pakistan People's Party hadn't had to suspend campaigning because of violence, that if it would have perhaps been able to cut into the huge margin of victory that Nawaz Sharif's PMLN party claimed.
Right. And Marvin, what's your opinion on the impact of the violence?
Well, I think that I agree with Michael, certainly, about that. Actually, I believe we're going to see figures upwards of 60% turnout, and that included women who were threatened very specifically in certain areas. They came to the polls. So there's a great deal that, despite the violence, which is indeed endemic to elections in the region, there was much, I think, to be very optimistic about. I would stress also the fact that now we will have a party coming to power pretty much on its own. Yes, there'll be a coalition of sorts with some independents, but he doesn't need to compromise with any other party, which means that he may be in a position to take on some really tough issues that Pakistan faces.
Right. Well, let's segue right into that, Marvin and then Michael. What do you see are the biggest challenges that Sharif will face as prime minister?
I believe he's got two main challenges here initially. One is going to be to establish working relationship with the military. His relationship with the military has been a very rocky one. He was, after all, ousted by the military in 1999. And came back in the election of 2008 to run. He had been in exile in Saudi Arabia for 7 years. He has in the past been unable to develop a working relationship. That's going to be one. And the other is how he's going to be able to address the problem of domestic extremism.
Right.
That's going to be, I think, quite a challenge.
Okay. And Michael, what do you think you are? How do you rate the top problems?
I would concur with Marvin on both of those, and I would throw in another major challenge, which perhaps is the most pressing one, and that's the economy. Mm-hmm. Certainly, militancy is a big domestic threat, but economic failure increasingly is as well. As I understand it, Pakistan only has about 5 or 6 weeks' worth of foreign reserves remaining. So mm-hmm. Pakistan really needs to act quickly, and I imagine that Nawaz Sharif will need to revisit a issue that no one was going to tackle before the election, and that's whether it's time to invite the IMF back to the country to request more funding, just because it's necessary. And you know, the economic problems tap into other major domestic challenges, such as the energy crisis, mm-hmm. which has caused there to be upwards of 10 to 12 hours of power outages every day. And as it gets into the really hot times of the year there, this becomes even more concerning. And the energy crisis is basically a money issue, because no one can afford to pay their bills. The energy companies aren't being paid, and they can't provide energy. And so really, there's a revenue shortage, there's a liquidity crisis, and it all comes down to the fact that the economy is a really serious problem. So I think that that'll be one of the first things that the new prime minister tries to address.
Right, and Sharif, he did campaign primarily on his ability to reinvigorate the economy and the electrical shortage, and he's a former steel baron who's considered a fiscal conservative, and he supports deregulation. So Marvin, did his main campaign message resonate?
Well, he is indeed someone who has experience as a businessman, and he also has around him people who are quite qualified in this area. And I agree with Michael very much so that this is going to be something that his government, just as in the previous government, is going to be judged by. People voted out the PPP, the People's Party, mainly because of the fact that they are suffering from this lack of electricity. There's been inflation. These economic problems are going to have to be addressed, it's not going to be easy. I'll mention one thing that he most directly is going to have to deal with, and that is to raise revenue.
Mm-hmm.
Without this, it's doubtful that the IMF is going to work with him to put the country on a little better footing economically.
Okay. And let's talk a bit about the effort to reduce the militants in Pakistan. What can be done to reduce the impact of the Taliban and the other militant groups?
Yeah, I mean that's a very tricky question, and there's so many different ways of answering it. And you know, on a very basic level, you know, I could just say this: that militants of all stripes in Pakistan operate in a climate of impunity. And this goes from attacks on government targets to religious minorities and the like. They commit their attacks. They get away with them. Rarely is anyone arrested, and even more rarely is anyone prosecuted. So there clearly, as a start, as a very basic thing, there needs to be more justice.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, of course, it's not that simple, because, of course, the Pakistani elements of the Pakistani security establishment tend to be selective in terms of who they consider a good extremist, who they consider a bad extremist, depending on the targets that they go after. But ultimately, I don't think that Nawaz Sharif or any prime minister can single-handedly address militancy. This is something that the military, the security establishment, will need to take charge of on its own.
Did you find it curious that the Taliban didn't target Sharif's party?
No, not at all, because the Taliban was specifically going after only the quote-unquote secular liberal parties, whereas the Sharif party tends to identify itself as more conservative, a bit more religious relative to the Pakistan People's Party and some of the other more liberal parties that the Taliban went after. And, of course, the Nawaz Sharif and also his brother have never really issued outright condemnations of Taliban violence. And, in fact, very famously, not too long ago, I believe it was Shahbaz Sharif that essentially asked the Pakistani Taliban to stay out of Punjab. There is no need for it to attack PMLN targets or anyone in Punjab because they were anti-American, just like the Taliban is. A really bizarre explanation. And so there's this very strange dynamic there, very strange.
Right. I'm going to move on to international relations, but there's somewhat of a tie, Marvin, in how Pakistan deals with the militants and how it gets along with India because of the attack in India. Do you see the tie there?
Most observers believe that one of the major new policy initiatives that Pakistan is going to adopt is a reaching out to India. Mm-hmm. Again, we have here the economic aspects of this. If Pakistan is going to improve its economy overall, there are many who believe it's got to have a much more fruitful relationship with India in terms of trade and exchanges. So I think that will certainly be the case. Now, if Nawaz Sharif does not get a grip on the extremist groups, what we might see is an effort on their part to derail this kind of development. So these are tied together. At the moment, there are many who believe that Nawaz Sharif is really a wolf in lamb's skin here, and that he really is a closet Islamist who's going to be very much like the radicals. I don't share that because, for one thing, he's got to have a working relationship with the United States, and he knows how that will go down with us. But also, as soon as he has the responsibilities of power and we have another attack, as we undoubtedly will, from the militants against the military, against civilians, it's going to be very hard for him not to begin to recognize the need to crack down on them.
And Michael, can you weigh in on this dynamic?
Well, I think in terms of India, I agree with Marvin. Nawaz Sharif has made some very conciliatory comments toward India since he's been elected. And in fact, I believe he invited India's prime minister to his swearing-in ceremony. And Prime Minister Singh has responded with some similar complimentary remarks. I think that, as Marvin says, Nawaz Sharif is a businessman. He knows that getting closer to India can bring great economic benefits to Pakistan. And the most immediate way to do that is to formalize a trade relationship with India. And they've gotten close. There's been a lot of momentum, but there are a few remaining steps that need to be taken. I imagine that those final steps will be taken by the Sharif government relatively quickly. Whether they go any further and reconcile and start talking about political issues is a very different story. And I would just echo what Marvin said, that unless Nawaz gets Punjab in order in the sense that something is done to these anti-India militants that use Punjab as a haven, I think that India will always continue to remain skeptical and mistrustful.
Right. And in our final minute, I wanted to ask each of you, Michael, starting with you, how this election might affect Pakistan's relations with the United States.
I actually don't think it'll affect the relationship with the United States much at all. Nawaz Sharif, despite some of the rhetoric we may have heard on the campaign trail, he wants to work with the United States, and the United States wants to work with him. They've worked with each other before. I don't see why there'll be a problem now. But ultimately, when it comes down to it, the U.S.-Pakistan relationship, Pakistan's relations with Washington, really come within the purview of the Pakistani military. And the military is not going anywhere. I would argue that the time we should be looking at, where there should be a bit more concern, is later this year when there's a transition in the military leadership. That's when you need to ask this type of question. But for now, I'm really not thinking there'll be any sort of noticeable impact one way or the other on the bilateral relationship.
And Marvin, the final word on that?
Well, I share that. I share those feelings. By and large, I think the United States has to be pleased even with the outcome. Right now, it knows it will have someone who is a partner in Pakistan and someone who can take responsibility for the problems that we are concerned about, particularly a government which will bring stability.
Right. Okay. Well,
I think it's very important.
I think we can leave it there. But thank you so much, gentlemen, for joining us today. This is going to be a fascinating ongoing story in the months ahead to see what moves he makes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good chatting with you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Now, before we move on to our next segment, I want to remind everyone that you can listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcasts from our website, globaljournalist.org. Please send us questions or comments via globaljournalist@kbia.org or visit our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter @globaljourn. Africa is on the rise. That proclamation came from Uhuru Kenyatta after he was sworn in as Kenya's latest president last month. The description also can be applied to Kenya in terms of its political stability, the economy, and the media. All three are on the rise. The brightest media star appears to be the Nation Media Group. The firm publishes newspapers and magazines, including the Daily Nation. They also operate radio and television stations. Olga Arara Kamani is an executive at the Nation Media Group. She visited the Global Journalist Studio last month to talk about Kenya's recent election, its foreign relations, and the state of journalism in the country. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So tell us a little bit about the rise, how your media company is doing. I understand that the overall profits are up a quarter from last year. What's the recipe for success?
Right. I think part of it was largely due to the elections, as you have already just mentioned. A lot of people wanted to know what was going on. This is the first time in Kenya that we're having a devolved government. Mm-hmm. So our change in constitution in the referendum in 2010 then brought in this new style of government where we're now going to have 47 counties with governors coming in for the first time. We now have a House of Senate for the first time in Kenya as well. So, and again, I think because there's also going to be a difference in the way we were going to vote. We would previously only have voted in three people in the last time. It would have been the president, you know, your MP and your councillor.
Right.
This time we had six ballot papers that you had to go through. So you had the president, and then you had a governor, and you had your MP, you had a county. We now have women representatives mm-hmm. in each of these 47 counties that we then also had to vote in. So a lot of interest around politics. People tend to believe in Kenya a lot more what is written in print. Mm-hmm. So while they would hear the same stories in TV and on radio, print
right.
tends to
be
the one.
And I understand that, that in most of the world, the print profits are plummeting, but with your publications, it's not that way. Tell us about that.
I think we've also been lucky that the trend in terms of the way the digital age has come into Africa has been a little bit slower than it has mm-hmm. been in the rest of the world. So most of the time, if people are still looking for information, it will be difficult for them to get it online.
Right.
It will more likely
be there.
And
your print profits are up significantly.
Yes, they are, 25% over the previous year. So this would have been numbers coming up to December 2012.
Wow.
So we're quite pleased with that. We do quite a bit of printing as well to cover the region mm-hmm. because we're not only covering Kenya. We're also present in Uganda, Rwanda, and Tanzania. So the plant that we have in Kenya also does contract printing for the rest of the regions. And we also do some work for China Daily. We're actually doing contract printing for China Daily as well.
Okay.
So that did contribute quite a bit to that.
Before we move on to the digital platform, let's continue talking a little bit about the political stability. And I understand in the previous presidential elections, there was a lot of violence. And this time, the Nation Media Group and was a leader in trying to ensure that the media coverage was responsible.
Right.
And it turned out that the elections were peaceful and declared valid, and even though it was a fairly narrow outcome.
Yes.
So tell us about what the media did before the election.
Okay. I think most of the world is aware in 2007, after our last elections, we did have the post-election violence. Part of that was actually attributed to the media, because a lot of Kenyans would still largely rely actually on radio to get a lot of the updates and information. So last year, Nation Media Group actually came up and brought together the rest of the media owners. We have a media owners association in Kenya that falls under the Media Council. And we all collectively agreed that we would follow a similar editorial policy where we would ensure that there was fair and balanced reporting and that we were not going to take mm-hmm. any sides, that it would right. be an impartiality. And most of the times we actually together agreed, driven by our group editorial director, I think, mm-hmm. who's visited you here right. before. And we just did fact checks on a lot of the stories that were coming out, mainly from constituency level, because that's where a lot of those grassroots stories are collected, to ensure that, you know, as much as possible, only messages of peace and nothing in terms of anyone who would be trying to incite people to come out would get any airplay. So I think that greatly contributed. But even before that, we came up for the first time in Kenya and had presidential debates where we brought together all the 8 presidential
and your
candidates.
Group sponsored them, right?
And our group sponsored that right. together with the rest of the media houses. Yeah. So it was being aired live at the same time across all the TV channels, so everybody countrywide could see it. And we felt it was also a way to give a platform to all these candidates who maybe would not have the same amount of campaign money to go around the whole country, but where mm-hmm. people could see them on a platform and get to ask them questions. Right. So citizens sent in quite a number of questions. I think we had to weed through maybe about 5,000 questions to select the number of questions that could be asked. And we ended up having a second presidential debate about 2 weeks later, so a few more questions could be answered. And I think that gave a good mm-hmm. you know, element to people getting to know a little bit better about the candidates before going out.
And did the economy in Kenya, let's talk about that and that aspect, because I imagine that having a healthy economy also fosters people's beliefs in the political system.
Right. Kenya, we're also lucky, if I would say that. We tend to serve as a hub quite a bit for especially people coming into East and Central Africa. Most of the times, if you're flying in, you would typically go through Nairobi mm-hmm. before you would connect into, you know, Kigali, which is in Rwanda, or Bujumbura in Burundi, or even into the Congo. Mm-hmm. So that, I think, already brings us quite a few of multinationals. But then more recently, there's been quite a bit of findings in terms of oil discovery mm-hmm. and coal. We are expanding our port in Lamu in terms of bringing in a lot more shipping lines from Asia coming mm-hmm. in to do trade into Africa. So I think that is giving rise to quite a bit of that. Government getting involved in sorting out a lot of the youth and unemployment issues that were coming in, investing a lot in education. Mm-hmm. So you tend to find as well that Kenyans will be much more literate than a lot more of the other people around the region. I think much more hardworking, if we say that, you know, right. ourselves. So I think these are contributors to how the economy is performing and looking to drive moving forward.
Okay. Let's circle back to what you're doing now. You've been at the Nation Media Group for 6 months now. Tell us about your charge, what they've brought you in to do.
Right. I joined NMG actually from Google, where mm-hmm. I was country manager for Kenya. What Nation is looking to do is to take advantage of what's happening, especially in the Western world, with a change in the digital age, where publishers, I think, maybe in the Western world were sort of caught, you know, on the back foot when the digital age came. Right. And a lot of the internet users then wanted to find information online. And they were then typically not going to buy a physical copy of a newspaper or subscribe to it. So we are using a lot of those key learnings, a lot of the case studies that the university has already done. And I have a group here that's been working on a project for us, the MBA students who are about to graduate.
Yes.
We're working on a project of how we can monetize the content, our archive that we have.
Okay. Yes. Now that the economy is getting healthier, you're getting more business, more activity, and more advertising. And you're also getting more competition from outside Africa. China's making a big play. Al Jazeera's coming in. I'm sure BBC's and other media outlets are also trying to get a piece of the action there. Talk about the international competition.
Actually, you're correctly so, as you've pointed out. Quite a few coming, but I think our competitive advantage is the intrinsic knowledge that we know, the local knowledge. It would be difficult, not impossible, for them to mirror the sort of systems and processes and the relationships that we've already built. even from a political viewpoint, the government relationships that we have, or even at the grassroots level through our correspondent network. So we find that even when they come in, they still come in and do partnerships with us, where we're able to syndicate part of our data going back in there. On the internet side, we have big watchouts actually coming from people like Google, because Google then is also a content aggregator.
Yeah.
And the challenge we have is a lot of the Google content is given for free because then Google wraps it around advertising. So we are trying to build a niche in that space and right. just see how this content that we have that we know that is unique to ourselves, that doesn't exist or is not already freely provided elsewhere, that we can protect it and then be able to put a paywall around it and get people to pay for that.
Before, you were an observer of the of Kenya's media. And now you're a part of it. Is it a lot different than you expected? Being inside?
Very different. I thought these guys just sat in the morning, you know, typed out stories and had these papers printed out or sat somewhere and just did TV. But there's a lot of reflection and thinking and balancing how the stories have to come out. So I've found that to be very interesting, how they're able to juggle those kind of competing interests that sometimes come up, where they even debate in terms of the front page news. Should it be something to do with some calamity that would have happened somewhere, you know, in northeastern Kenya? Or is it a big business story about an investment that would have come? So I found that I appreciate it a lot more. It's right. much more complicated when you're inside as opposed to how it looks from the outside.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, it's been a delightful conversation. I appreciate you taking the time to be on our program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye now. That was my interview with Olga Arara Kimani, recorded last month. Olga is the general manager in charge of group and business development and innovation for the Nation Media Group. Global Journalist is produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Our program is directed by Travis McMillan, audio by Pat Akers. Raymond Tungakar is our executive producer. Stay with us for Free Press Watch. And please join us again next week for another Global Journalist. I'm David Reed.
I'm Nassim Ben-Shaban. It's time for your weekly Free Press Watch, a segment on Global Journalist where we bring you a rundown of major events affecting press freedom around the world. Today we have news from Iran and Russia, but we begin here in the U.S. This week, it was revealed that the Justice Department secretly seized telephone records of Associated Press reporters over a two-month span. Reporters indicate the seizure may have been connected to an investigation into the source behind an AP report on a foiled terrorist plot. Gary Pruitt, the CEO of the AP, has protested what he called a massive and unprecedented intrusion into AP's news-gathering activities. In Iran, the treatment of journalists and media has continued to decline as the June presidential election approaches. Recent arrests and harassment are part of a widespread and worsening government crackdown on the press. The Committee to Protect Journalists estimates that 40 journalists currently are being held in prison in the country. In Russia, the suspected mastermind behind a journalist murder in 2000 was arrested on May 8th in Moscow, according to the Associated Press. Igor Domnikov, who worked for the Moscow newspaper Novaya Gazeta, was attacked outside his apartment by a group of men and later died from the injuries. Pavel Sopot has now been arrested on charges of ordering the attack, but denies the allegations. You can find more about these and other events affecting press freedom around the world at globaljournalist.org. Thank you for joining us for Free Press Watch. I'm Nassim Ben-Shaban. See you next week.